Way down in Missouri, where I heard this melody when I was a little.
Welcome to Show Me Missouri, the history of Missouri, one county at a time. This week we are in Iron County, the 108th county formed by the state, February 16th, 1857. We are in the historic courthouse, and you know, you can go to a lot of parts in the state, and they can say, you know, there was a battlefield here or there. Very few of them said the battlefield was at the courthouse, and they still got the scars to prove it. So I want to thank everybody for joining us this week. I'm Scott Fun. I want to go around and have everybody just introduce yourselves to everybody listening here in Iron County and how your title and how you came to be involved.
My name is Jim Skaggs. I'm the presiding commissioner of Iron County.
And I'm John Abney. I'm a past president of the Iron County Historical Society.
I'm Josh Campbell, Western District Commissioner.
So, Commissioner Campbell, tell me, how do you come to live here in Iron County?
My family's been here since before it was farmed, the Trollingers and Stricklands, and the other family members was here when part of it was Reynolds County, and then the Campbells, the side of my family, come here in the early 1900s, late 1800s.
Mr. Abney, you're with the Historical Society. Now, before we get into you, tell folks how they want to learn more about Iron County. Is there a website they can go to? Is there a museum here in the county?
Yes, there is a museum here. It's in the historic train station in Arcadia, which is also now an Amtrak station as of November 2016. That we share that building with the Arcadia Valley Chamber of Commerce.
And how'd you come to live here in Iron County?
Well, I didn't grow up here. My mother was from Iron County. My roots, like Josh's, go back some 200 years. I also had families that lived up in the northwestern part of the county. And so even though I grew up in St. Louis, my folks were from down here. I retired from the military, and I have always loved this area. And this is where I wanted to come when I retired, and that's what I did.
Commissioner, how'd you come live here in Iron County?
I've lived here all my life. I'm the fifth generation of our family that's been here. My son and my grandson both live here in Iron County, so hopefully they'll carry the tradition along.
What do you do when you're not commissioner?
Well, I actually own a business in Wayne County, providing agricultural lime to row crop farming operations up and down the Mississippi Delta River area. I also farm, have cattle. And in my spare time, I volunteer for a lot of needed organizations.
That spare time sounds a little bit scarce. Well, like I said, the county was formed in February 16, 1857 by the legislature. Now, Iron County is one of the last counties formed in the state. But let's back up. There was a post office here before there was a county. Now, there's two different stories on this. One goes back to 1839, they had a post office here, and one was a little closer to when that one notation was a little closer when they formed the county. But they all say Colonel Cyrus Russell was the first postmaster, dating back to prior to there even being a county. The county was cut out of parts of Wayne, Reynolds, Madison, Washington, Dent, St. Francis County. The state representative from Madison County, Major John Polk, was carried the bill, along with State Senator C.C. Ziegler. They decided to make Iron a county. Now, it seems like, because of the timing of when Iron County became a county and the size of it, it was cut up in interesting shape. It's got kind of an L shape, or however you want to look at it, a right angle. There were several Missouri counties made right before the Civil War in anticipation of the Constitutional Convention. What do folks around here say why Iron County is a county?
Most people around here said we're cut out because nobody wanted us. But really, I think it was because of the natural resource deposits that we had. It's kind of unique. Iron County got its name after the iron ore deposits in our county. And I think what we call the West End, or the west of the L, if you would, is where all the lead deposits came from. Of course, they wasn't identified back that early, but I really think it was because of the contour of the way the county runs. The railroad run from St. Louis into Iron County to haul the iron ore back. So I really don't know why it was designed or drew the way it is, other than the old people that talked to me said nobody wanted us.
Mr. Abney, around here might not have been the easiest for Indians to live. There wasn't a lot of farming, but you could hunt, right? What kind of Indians were here prior to?
Well, we've got a display of Native American artifacts over at the museum that were all taken from one location, a farm in Arcadia. And they actually date back anywhere from 19th century all the way back 10,000 years or so. Everything from Clovis points to something more modern. So there's been any number of tribes that have called this area home. Of the historical tribes, we know that at the time of Marquette and Joliet's exploration of the Mississippi, the Illinois Indians were here. Mm-hmm. After that came the Osage. There were Delaware here at one time. There was a group of Cherokee that left long before the forced removal that were actually over in an area of St. Francis County. And then they had the 1811-1812 earthquake, so they took that as a sign they went to the wrong place. And so they went on down to Arkansas. So we've had any number of tribes, but with westward expansion of the European settlers, the Indians were forced ever westward. So
Sure. Mr. Campbell, what do you say, what kind of decade back in the 1800s would your family have settled here?
Probably about the 1840s. I know that there's records of our family being in Reynolds County in the 1840s. Mm-hmm.
And would they have came up through Tennessee, Kentucky? They came down from St. Louis?
Yeah, most of them come through Kentucky. They were from Virginia. Mm-hmm. Halberts were from South Carolina. So they all come from the far east part and came up through Tennessee and in that way.
So interesting, you know, the Osage Indians have always been the tribe that hated white people the most. They didn't want anything to do with them. And kept people on the other side of the river for a long time. The Jefferson County folks can tell you some pretty rough stories. So they might have moved out after that earthquake to a certain extent so folks could settle. It's kind of interesting how those things, those migration patterns take place. Commissioner Skaggs, your family, how'd they come through? Did they come through Tennessee, Kentucky? Where'd they come from?
Well, as far back as we can trace the history, my great-great-grandfather come from Tennessee. We don't know where they come from before that. That goes back into the 1700s. They migrated from Tennessee into, it, at that time, what they called Reynolds County. Mm-hmm. And that's where our family originated from. My great-great-grandmother was supposedly Indian native, and we have no geological or genealogical data on where she actually came from. Mm-hmm. So we've been able to trace him, my great-great-grandfather, back to 1700, and they came from Tennessee. This area is known for a lot of the Trail of Tears routes. The Hildebrand route is the most famous, ran right through Iron County, right
and
through
now the Hildebrand route, for folks who don't know, tell me where that would have started and where that would have ended.
Well, it started in Tennessee, but it ended in Oklahoma, I believe, to the Indian Reservation back in 1830s is when that mm-hmm. come through. So we had two Trail of Tears routes. One of them was Hildebrand,
and the lady just brought the information to us the other day on the second
the
one.
Other route that they had called, but there was a lot of historic Trail of Tear Indian mm-hmm. travel through our county, and some believe, a lot of the old-timers talk about, that some of those people that was on that Trail of Tears had actually dropped off from
sure.
that massive movement of Indians, and some stayed in this area.
Well, this would be a tough, if you're just going to walk across America, Iron County, you run into some hills.
Oh.
Might be easier to go through Sykeson or something, you know?
It's very tough. It's very tough. The hills are, well, we have one of the tallest mountains in the state of Missouri with Tom Salk mm-hmm. Mountain. So
I grew up on a rock farm myself. There's hills and rocks. It ain't normally the easiest to walk through, you know?
No. Well, a lot of people say we don't farm here, we farm rocks.
Yeah.
And that's our agriculture.
Was the first county court had an election to see who was going to serve on it. And the first Monday in June 1857, they moved pretty quick back in the day from when they established the state to having their election. Interesting, you know, early in Missouri history, the state would appoint a commission, a temporary one, of people from other counties to find a county seat and what have you. But I guess as time went on, there's a lot of fights over where that county seat's going to be and who's going to serve. And so they let them have, they had their own election. The first county court had John V. Logan, John Miller, Moses Edmonds. The first sheriff was John Cole, and the judge was John Stone. They had their first actual meeting on August 4th, 1857, and then they set up an election for a county seat September 7th, 1857. They still had a little drama about that, didn't they? A little bit of a fight over where it was actually going to be. You know the story?
Yeah, they actually held an election.
Yeah.
And the problem that they had is the towns that were put up for it, none of them were able to obtain a majority. There were a couple of local businessmen by the name of Tong and Carson that operated a store at the base of Shepherd Mountain in what is now Ironton. And they had bought up a lot of land from Cyrus Russell Sr. and others. And they had a plat made of that land, and they went before the county court and offered to sell alternate lot. Well, they were going to sell all the lots in the plat, and they would donate the money from the alternate lots to the construction of a courthouse if Ironton were to be selected as the county seat. And at that time, Ironton wasn't even in existence.
It came in 1858, right?
That's correct.
And they were having that election in 1857 and never... So the other county said, well, if you're putting up the money, we'll let you have it?
They had the vote, and they got enough votes, and that's what they did. The sale of the lots raised somewhere around $10,000 towards the construction of the courthouse. The original cost of the construction was about $14,000.
We were able to find George Evans and William Mitchell got selected in April of 1858 after they had plotted the town. They laid the cornerstone on July 4th of 1858. Now, you can tell the history of a county by their courthouse in many different ways. You come in and see a beautiful courthouse like this, you would think it would be your second or third courthouse. But as I understand it, this is the original one that made it through the Civil War even.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Now, was this a brick building when it was built? What was this when it was built?
It's pretty much original right now. The way you see it is the way it was, except for the addition in 1964. In 1957, they still had outdoor restrooms and wood stoves that heated the courthouse, and they would sprinkle sawdust and oil on the floor to collect the dust and sweep it out in the evenings for dust control.
Almost every wooden courthouse in the state of Missouri that was original burned. Madison County is the only one that might not have, just because through fire, wood heat, whatever you want to say, Confederate Union troops. The brick courthouses it's an interesting thing. Usually when a town changed hands, they'd burn the courthouse because they'd hold up, and if it was brick, it'd be a good place to defend. This courthouse escaped, burning by either side, with both sides coming through. That's an interesting thing, and what a piece of history. And I've heard my whole life, I've been to Ironton several times, but I've never got to actually see. If you come to Ironton, you can see the courthouse where was it a cannonball or what there's a bullet hole fragment chip away. What is there, Commissioner?
On the front side of the courthouse, on the east end, if you look up at the top, and we've got it painted black, so it's very easy to see. You can see where the cannonballs actually hit the courthouse, where they fired upon the courthouse back during the Civil War Battle of Pilot Knob.
Now, I want to talk about the Battle of Pilot Knob in Fort Davidson after the break, but who shot the cannon into the – was it the Union or the Confederates?
I think it was a Confederate.
It was
artillery.
Yeah.
They did? Well, usually when you lose, you get blamed anyhow. So
yeah.
Maybe this one they come by honestly, you know. So leading up to this was in 1857, the St. Louis and Iron Mountain Railroad come through. And that was what that was coming to a lead depository or iron?
No, it was iron. It actually got to Pilot Knob in April of 1858.
Is when they actually got completed, and that was to the iron was for everything. What was the iron primarily used for at the time?
Well, they would ship it to St. Louis. I mean, a big part of St. Louis's economy in the latter half of the 19th century was based on the iron that was coming out from Iron Mountain and Pilot Knob.
Well, there's even like the Plank Road to St. Genevieve, right?
There was the Plank Road that was actually, it opened in 1855. It went from Iron Mountain and Pilot Knob all the way over to St. Genevieve. It was a toll road, and it only lasted for 3 years because of the railroad. And the railroad got here, and it displaced the need for the Plank Road.
It's amazing. I think that people that don't really take the time to look at why things are the way they are, they sleep a little bit on how much of the history of this state was tied to that mine. There's so many things that happened in this state that might have happened, but it would have been more expensive to ship it, or just never happened, or happened somewhere else because of that mine. That mine changed the whole landscape of pre-Civil War Missouri.
Well, that's why we got the railroad. That's why we were strategically important. That's why the Union troops came here.
So,
and the whole northern part of Iron County, which stretches into Bellevue Valley, which goes into southern Washington County up to Potosi, that's where the lead mines originated in the 1780s. Bellevue Valley was settled in the 1780s from Caledonia south into Bellevue and up into Potosi. And that's why we're kind of tied in with Washington County a lot, and part of us come from Washington County, was because of the lead mines that come here, was here and made a lot of a big difference in the history here.
Interesting thing. We'll take a break, come back. I always want to thank our sponsors, CFM Insurance, the Missouri Association of Co-ops, Farm Bureau, and the Missouri Association of Counties, for letting you bring Show Missouri to you each week, where we get to come tell you the history of Missouri one county at a time. This week we're here in Iron County. We'll be right back and talk about the Battle of Pilot Knob after this.
We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and we're for the Missouri way of life. We're for worrying less about the what-ifs and more about the why-nots. We're for checking off your bucket list and then making a new one, for starting a family, a business, a tradition. And if you find yourself starting over, we're here for that too. We're for building a life in Missouri and then going out and living it. And when it comes to making sure everything you've built is protected, we're for you. We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and we've got Missouri covered for life.
Welcome back to Showing Missouri, the history of Missouri, one county at a time. We are in the historic, battle-scarred Iron County Courthouse here in Iron County in Ironton, Missouri. We're joined this week by Commissioner Campbell. Thank you for staying with us, sir.
Yes, sir.
John Abney with the Historical Society. Appreciate you joining us and sticking around.
Glad to be here.
And Commissioner Skaggs, we'll talk about the thing that everybody, if you're from southeast Missouri, maybe anywhere in Missouri, you've always heard of the battle. I guess they call it the Battle of Fort Davids in some of the books, but I always heard it as the Battle of Pilot Knob. I don't think people quite, if you don't really know the history leading up to it, you can't grasp the significance of it. I think people think about some other skirmishes, but at the time, the backdrop was President Lincoln, he was up for re-election. And I think, obviously, commissioners, you would never do this or anybody you know, but at times, commissioners or presidents, you like to have a good showing when you're up for re-election. I think just common sense. You want things to be going well, whatever office you happen to be in. Well, the war really started to turn in that year, and I think President Lincoln wanted to make sure that as he stood for re-election, he was in good shape. It's when Atlanta fell and other things. Well, in the Western Theater, this was where former governor, Missouri governor, and General Sterling Price was going to make his charge. Now, originally he'd planned to come up in and take St. Louis because of all the arms and things they had. But if you were going to St. Louis from, he left out of Camden, Arkansas, you might go up 55, you might go up 67. Back in the day, you would come right here to Ironton, Pilot Knob, and take the railroad. The backdrop of it is rich in Missouri history because obviously you have a former governor leading one side. That's always interesting. But one of the most hated men in Missouri history ever was the Union general here. I would say Don Dinkinger might be the most evil person in Missouri history. But right after him would have to be General Ewing. He's the one that wrote General Order 11, where they raped, murdered, depopulated four counties. We've talked about the movie Outlaw Josie Wales was based on Clint Eastwood was a farmer that General Ewing had attacked, and it's an amazing thing. No matter where you are in history, the difference between a terrorist and a freedom fighter is a crazy thing. If you a U.S. senator leading a group of people to rape and murder Missourians from Kansas, and they're called patriots, but you go to Western Missouri. We was in Barton County last week. They don't think too highly of the Kansas folks and them.
Right.
So in September of 1864, General Price, or you might know him as Governor Price in Missouri, they left Camden, Arkansas, was planning to take St. Louis. It was going to be called Price's Raid, and the first place they would come is Pilot Knob, and because of the mine and everything here, there was a place, Fort Davidson. The first thing that they saw was they cut the railroad line, and at that point, General Ewing knew the attack was coming, which I don't think it was a surprise. Yeah, today you can't move two people around without being on Facebook, but even you couldn't move tens of thousands of people even then without knowing they were coming. Price had around 12,000 men, but only about 9,000 of them were actually armed. Ewing had around 1,300, they call them irregulars, some African-Americans were in his detachment, 200 regulars of the Iowa infantry. And then on September 26th, Price started the fight. Now, the Battle of Pilot Knob, or Fort Davis, if you want to break it up, was 2 days. The first day they come in, they pulled everyone into Ironton. Is that right, Mr. Abney?
That's correct.
Now, what you want? What when folks talk about this battle, what's the conventional wisdom here? What happened?
The Price's raid was probably one of the worst-kept secrets of the entire sure. Civil War. The Union generals, Rosecrans, who was in charge of Missouri, knew it was going to happen. He just didn't know exactly where or when it would take place. They had planned to react as soon as they could actually determine it, but they never really figured it out until it happened. Even when Ewing got here, even though there was a band reported over in Fredericktown, and Confederate bands don't travel without a general. Even when a band was reported over in Fredericktown, Ewing still didn't believe it was the main force of Price's army. What Price had done when he left Arkansas is he divided his forces into three columns, and they came up three different routes. And so that confused the Union generals. I don't know why they didn't have cavalry scouts. I don't know why they couldn't have figured it out. But Ewing actually didn't figure it out until the first night of the battle. And by the time he figured it out, it was too late. He couldn't get away because his orders were to get out mm-hmm. and to blow up the powder magazine at the fort. And by the time he figured out what was going on, he couldn't do it.
And they cut the railroad line, right?
They cut the railroad line. He sent Price sent his best commander, which was Joe Shelby, up north of Potosi, up by Mineral Point, and they cut the railroad line there. Mm-hmm.
So the first day, they begin the battle, and Ewing pulls his soldiers back into the town, right?
Yeah. What happened is they were coming in on the Confederate forces were coming in on the Fredericktown Road, and there were Union pickets out there that saw them coming. And
what would Fredericktown Road be today?
Fredericktown Road is basically Highway 72.
Yeah.
And so the Union pickets saw them coming. They sent word back to the fort. The Confederates actually made it into Ironton, and the fighting was up and down Main Street. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. there were Union troops from sitting in this courthouse firing out at the Confederates.
So the Confederates were shooting a cannonball on the wall. Normally, when the Union was holding somewhere and the Confederates come through, they burned it. Why do you think they didn't burn it?
Well, you got to remember that this was only the first element of Price's forces mm-hmm. that had gotten here. They were actually under orders not to do anything unless they thought they could go in and do something very quickly and win.
Where was Price?
Price was still at Fredericktown when this was going on.
So they come in, folks withdraw into the town, and then after the first day they realize they better withdraw.
Well, the Union forces forced them back into the Stout Creek shut-ins, and that's where they were that night. And that night, this is after Ewing comes down on the train, and he brings reinforcements with him on the train, and they can see the thousands of campfires down by the shut-ins, and that's when they figured out what they were up against. So, and that was when the rest of Price's forces made it in.
And then the Union then withdrew into Fort Davidson, right?
That's correct.
So the picture is an interesting thing. You can literally, and I always think that's a great thing about Missouri, you know, I don't think anybody alive today can really get their mind around what a war would be like. I can't imagine what a war would be like in Iraq or Vietnam anywhere, but I don't think anybody even here can imagine what a war is like in Ironton, Missouri. I think it's, I don't think you could probably, it's probably something, it's like being in war anywhere. You probably can't really get your mind around it unless you've lived it. But when you talk about everything stops in a war, and you've got people shooting at a courthouse, like trying to kill each other, no show, it's not terrorism. This is actually two armies of armed people trying to murder each other. And you can drive down from Fredericktown, one of the prettiest roads, one of the most beautiful roads in the state of Missouri is 72 between here and Fredericktown. You could not find a prettier way to drive. But driving through, Price comes over, and he has, they're outnumbered 10-1. Now, as I understand it, they moved into the fort, right? The next day, they go inside the fort where it's fortified.
The Union.
Yes.
So there's two different ways to look at it. The way you might write history, history, that's why it's so great to get what folks have told other people here in Iron County about it. Some folks said that Price was going to surrender. They offered, Price offered surrender terms to Ewing and tried to entice him to surrender the fort. Ewing, some would say that because he had some African Americans in his attachment, he did not want to surrender them because they'd been treated very, very poorly, even killed other times when Southern troops had come across African-American prisoners of war. However, other people thought because Ewing had been so evil and cruel to the people in Western Missouri, where Price was had family ties and knew very well, they thought he might kill Ewing. Why do you think Price didn't surrender? Why do you think Ewing didn't surrender to Price?
I think you pretty much covered it. That this was actually after the second day of the battle, and he had gathered his officers together and said that they basically had three options. They could surrender.
Well, before we do that, let me back up a little bit. Tell me about this fort. This is when you think of a fort, there's all different types of forts. This was an amazingly well-defended fort.
It was an earthwork fort. The walls were about 12 feet high, and then there was a dry moat.
About 10 feet thick, right?
About 10 feet
yeah.
thick.
Yeah.
It's not a fort where you're going to have barracks or anything like that. It's just an earthwork.
Because of the width of the walls and because it's an earthwork fort, you couldn't stand through there and shoot. You had to sit over the top of the hill, right? Because
yes.
it's an earthwork fort.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The fort was actually they started construction on that fort in 1863. It's not the valley's first fort.
Mm-hmm.
The first fort was actually built in Arcadia. It was initially called Fort Hovey.
Now, who's that named after?
That was named after Colonel Hovey, who was the commander of the Normal Regiment that came from Normal, Illinois, from the Normal School.
Cool.
And he was here for about 6 months, but after the Battle of Pea Ridge, they renamed it to Fort Curtis, after General Curtis.
Now, tell me about why Fort Davidson is named Fort Davidson.
Well, it's named after John Davidson.
Davidson, yeah.
And they started construction on that fort in 1863.
But tell folks who John Davidson is.
He was a Civil War, he was a Brigadier General.
General, yeah.
And they started construction on that fort in 1863. There was a large number of freed blacks. They were called contraband slaves that had come followed the army back up from Pea Ridge and other places. And they had barracks, and they put them to work building the fort. And at the end, they actually forced some Iron Countyans to come help finish it up because they were behind schedule on it.
Yeah.
And so it actually opened in 1864. The problem with the fort—
By forced, you mean they paid them, or they just—
conscripted. That's when the first draft came out, in 1863.
But they more or less drafted them into working to finish the fort. The vulnerability of the fort was the fact that it was surrounded on hills, on three sides by hills. And so it made it very vulnerable to artillery attack.
Could you shoot down into the fort from the hills?
Yes.
Yeah,
Confederate
artillery spots on Shepherd Mountain that you can see on the Shepherd Mountain Trail now. And that's where I don't remember the batteries was, but the Confederate artillery fired down on Fort Davidson from up there.
The problem was, for those Confederates, that the artillerymen inside the fort had been there for a couple of years, and they practiced by shooting.
Practice.
They practiced by shooting at tops of trees up on Shepherd Mountain, and their cannons were rifled. So they had a longer range and increased accuracy. And so when the Confederates did start firing down from Shepherd Mountain, they were pretty much sitting ducks. And it did not take long for them to get knocked out. And then Price had to decide, well, this didn't work, so what are we going to do next?
So this day, the Union forces are outmanned 10-1, but they have a pretty good defense. And it's just a slaughter for the Confederates.
It is. I don't want to offend anybody that likes General Price, but Price was not the sharpest tool in the Confederate toolbox. He planned a four-pronged simultaneous attack on the fort. They were going to have Confederate troops coming from four directions at the same time. They were going to overwhelm the fort's defenses. It was a brilliant plan. It's just this is 1864. There's no such things as radios. There's no way to coordinate the attack. When the attack starts, each prong comes in one at a time, and each prong is beaten back by the Union troops. The closest the Confederates got was to the dry moat, and without scaling ladders, there was no way that they could get over the walls of the fort. And it was, like you said, it was a slaughter for the Confederates.
You think, I've always read where Price was picked because he was a former governor, and he would tell the Confederate establishment that he could rally the state behind him.
Well, that was the thought, that he, when old Pappy come back to home, that he could rally the men and people would just come to him in droves. And
which happened a little early in the war, but did not happen in this raid.
No. Yeah. And some people think that the reason why the big push was to come into St. Louis was to draw the attention away from the Union Army from Virginia, where they were just, you know, really holding up General Lee. And
burning Atlanta, Georgia.
And Atlanta, you know, they had the Anaconda campaign was going on, and they was trying to pull some of the focus and get their attention withdrawn from the Eastern Front back to the Western Front. And the Western Front was just a terrible campaign for the Confederacy from the very beginning, and they was trying to pull the attention to St. Louis and get some of the Union forces drawn back over here. And it just didn't work.
And Price was a political appointee. I mean, that's the reason. Sure. It was politics is the reason he was put in charge. He wasn't the best general for the job. He had never, never led a cavalry raid. And before it was a raid, it was going to be an invasion. It was going to be cavalry backed up by infantry. So whatever places they took, they would hold then with cavalry, with infantry, that would come in from behind. By the time the raid actually happened, there was no infantry contingent involved. And you got to remember, too, even though it was a cavalry raid, about a quarter of Price's troops didn't have horses. I mean, they didn't have guns. Didn't have guns, but they didn't have horses either. So they moved very slowly. So it's not all Price. But
So there's a slaughter. From that first day, I've never trusted fully these numbers, especially the Confederate numbers, but they lost, the Union quotes about 200 casualties. Price, you know, what about, is it 1,500, you'd say?
There might have been that many wounded. The numbers range from about 300 to 500 dead, and then a whole lot of others wounded. You got to remember that with one of the assaults, it was basically over an open field. And you had the forces inside the fort firing canister shot, which is like it's more or less like what you would describe as a shotgun shell.
Yeah.
With different size shot. It could be a couple of inches. It could be up to 4 or 5 inches. But they would hold anywhere from 12 to 25 or even more of this shot. And they're firing it straight out at the infantry troops that are coming. And they just fall in waves.
It's just the techniques of the time. War had changed. The generals didn't really know it because they had been taught that you marched up and matched your men. You matched your fire and you matched your men. And that's what they did throughout the entire Civil War. That's why we had 60, 70, 80% casualties in these battles. And it was just the techniques. They thought to take the fort, you had to march up the field and match your fire. And they got blown away on the open field.
So your General Ewing, people forget he was the brother-in-law of General Sherman. Going through Atlanta, you have some African Americans, and so you are concerned. There's been documented times where the Confederates were very unkind to African American Union soldiers or conscripts or whatever you want to call them. And then you have General Price as you way out man, but you beat him back the first day. There is a limit. You can't really get reinforcers with this type of huge numerical value. You're sitting there. You've also raped and pillaged and murdered a big chunk of Western Missouri under your command, and you think, well, they might take a little revenge back on me. General Price is a person from North Central Missouri with family that is over in the Kansas City area where some of these atrocities were committed by the United States government. You're in that place, and you take a war council, and you decide, what do they decide? They decide to head out, right?
They decide to head out. They had the three options. They could stay and fight. They knew if they did that, they heard the sounds of the troops making scaling ladders. They knew what was going to happen the next day if they did that. They could surrender. But as you mentioned, Ewing even said that they will not Fort Pillow me. And he was referring to Fort Pillow, where after the Union black troops surrendered there, that they were shot after they surrendered.
Yeah, it pretty much annihilated everybody
It wasn't just the African Americans. It wasn't just Ewing. You also had the 3rd Missouri State Militia, which was the actual unit that was in charge of that fort. They had a very poor reputation as well as to how they treated the locals. So all of those troops would have been in danger. And so that's why they decided in the end that their best option was to try to leave the fort and to get away.
So I guess to me, being the fog of war is one thing, but you have now 10,000 people looking after 1,000 people, and 1,000 people sneak out. 1,000 people make a little noise, right? Then they blow the camp. They blow the fort up, right?
That's correct.
How do you do that?
Well, it helps when the road that you need to use is the one road that's left open. And that's exactly what happened.
Yep.
They needed to escape using
Fort Davidson's big, but it's not that big. I've been there.
It's not that big, but you got to remember the Confederates aren't camped right outside the walls. Yeah. Because they would be in danger of being picked off by snipers. So they're a ways back. So, and this is the middle of the night. They muffle the wheels of the carts going out of the sally port at the fort. So they try to deaden the sound as much as they can. It's in the dark of night. The only thing that lights their way, really, is they have set the charcoal on fire up at the iron mines. So there is a light. But they're able to get out onto this road. The Confederates that are there think it's just another Confederate unit that is coming in to take up their position.
Well, and Shelby was in the north.
And Shelby was in the north.
He was coming south anyway.
And he was coming south anyway.
So, you know, that was probably something else too. And
so that's what they thought was going on. And then a couple hours later, the powder magazine blows up. And when that happens, the Confederates that are there think, well, they've blown themselves up. We'll go in first thing in the morning and we'll clean up and do whatever. Because they thought it was an accident. They did not think it was a deliberate act. Price was asleep in Arcadia and claims to not even have heard the explosion.
Commissioner, they talk about that technology today, you could push a button on your phone and blow something up maybe. Back then, how would you set – they had to set a very timed explosive, right, so they could get out. How would you set an explosive like that back in 1864?
Well, whenever we have the battle reenactment, that whole two-day battle in the night is reenacted. And they essentially just set up primer cord, black powder trail, back into where all their ammunition was, and set it on fire.
Now, I'm thinking like Wile E. Coyote pulling off something like this. It never works. You'd have to just run it around a bunch of times to...
No, they actually had all their black powder stored in and put it in one central location and then run a stream back to it.
It'd be a long stream, right?
Better be.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, long enough for them to get away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they went up to Rolla, right?
Eventually they did, yes.
That was where they was headed.
That's where they were headed.
Actually, they was headed to Jeff City.
They were. Well, in fact, they were they thinking about St. Louis, but when they got to Caledonia, that's when they ran into the advanced elements of Shelby's units coming south. And so they realized they couldn't go east and they couldn't go north, and so they went out on the Webster Road and ended up that night at Webster and then on from there to Leesburg and then on from there to Rolla.
Yeah.
So when you think about Price's Raid, you think about how it ends and different things in Jeff City. But in all reality, the plan was for the former governor to come back, march to St. Louis. He lost a lot of his best troops. Publicly, it was a humiliation for him that they snuck out in the middle of the night on him. It seemed like at that point he decided St. Louis was not a reality.
Price was incensed when he found out that the Union forces had gotten away. And instead of taking the action that he should have taken, because he still could have marched on Jefferson City, but he decides to chase after Ewing instead, and he loses a couple of days by going after Ewing.
Yeah.
So he also got held up in Herman, got held up there, and ends up not even going to Jeff City, right?
Right. Well, by the time he gets to near Jeff City, it is well defended, and he knows that he will have no success there.
So the story ends with him going to Westport, him going then to was the Battle of there's a Battle of Mine Creek in Kansas.
Mine Creek, yeah.
Where it really ends. And he ends up in Mexico for a while, right, before he gets to come back. He offers his brilliant military strategies to the Mexican emperor, and he says, no thanks, Maximilian.
But by the time they got to Mine Creek, they had something like 300 wagons of booty that they had collected from across the state. And remember, part of what they had hoped was going to happen with Price was that he would come back in because there was the Loyal Order of Oaks or whatever it was called.
Yeah.
There was a secret organization that more people were going to join. By the time the Price got done with Missouri, he was just robbing and pillaging and everything else. So it sort of had the opposite effect.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing. You look in a lot of places in southern Missouri, especially southwest Missouri, they started off very pro-Confederate. But when what happened would be like in Bolivar, the Union, that's where the railroad had stopped when the war started. There was a huge Union depot there, so a lot of the people did business with the Union, and they got along with them. Rolla, same way. That's where the railroad stopped, so that's where they had a they liked the Union. The Confederate armies, everybody, they might have supported them, but when they come and foraged your farm once or twice, you were pretty well ready for them to go away and just, you know, lose.
Yeah.
Where the Union army had supplies being railroaded in from all over, they didn't have to forage and steal for the most part from the population. And I think that's an interesting thing. You saw the people in southern Missouri turn. The more they had to support this army by force without any choice, they weren't as in on them. Ewing would go on to have a career in Congress. He would run for governor of Ohio and lose. And really, to the victor goes the spoils. If you did today what General Ewing did in western Missouri, you'd surely be court-martialed and imprisoned, right? But I guess in a war, if you win, then you're a patriot.
News traveled slow back then.
That's bad. All right. Clint Eastwood could have got a hold of him, though. That'd have been all for General Ewing. But really what happens is if you're listening to this and you're from St. Louis, the reason you don't have a scar in your courthouse is probably because the folks at the Battle of Pilot Knob, it's like everything with the Confederacy in Missouri, even Wilson's Creek, even the battles they won, just they would take a step toward winning a battle, but they'd take two steps toward losing the war. And in Pilot Knob is really where the big Western push really ended.
Yes.
It wasn't a serious thing until after Pilot Knob.
Well, by that time, the war was coming down anyway. It was September of 64.
Yeah.
You know, you had Atlanta and Vicksburg, you know, and all that had fell in 64, so in July. So it was coming down fast anyway then.
So before the war, was this a Union county or Confederate county?
It was a county that wanted to be left alone.
Yeah.
When they held the election of 1860, Mr. Lincoln came in third. And the general feeling was that they were not pro-slavery, they were not pro-abolition, they just wanted to be left alone. But that was the same as it was in the rest of the state. Lincoln came in third in Missouri overall.
If you could have had a vote, I think, in the state of Missouri, support the Union, support the Confederacy, or leave us the hell alone, I think leave us the hell alone would have came in very high.
Yeah, very high. It would have won out.
Yeah. It's an interesting, you know, today you're taught, you know, even in schools, but certainly in the media, that either pro-slavery or anti-slavery, I think most, even Governor Fox Jackson, he raised a militia to repel all invaders.
Yes.
From every side. And I think it's an interesting thing. Most folks in Missouri, you know, they'd had the border war where a United States senator had been coming over and raping women and killing men and stealing and robbing and burning down towns. You just wanted the whole thing to go away.
Why you had the Kingdom of Callaway, because Callaway County wanted to secede from everybody. They didn't want to be a part of it, you know. So that's
and here there was no crops for slavery. Really, slavery wasn't used in mining. Slavery wasn't used in cattle. If you know the row crops were not a thing where slavery was a part of the life here in Iron County.
There were slaves here. There were about 500 slaves at the time of the 1860 census, but that only represents about 5% of the total population. So it wasn't like places like Little Dixie or where there was no plantation type environment.
After the war and they were free, that did not change the fundamental economy of Iron County, did it?
No, it didn't change the fundamental economy. It changed for African Americans because a lot of the African Americans that were slaves, enslaved in Iron County, I don't really think they stayed here. I think that was pretty common for most. They left. But there was a large number of blacks that came to Iron County during the war. And they ended up staying here, and they raised families here, and they were here for generations.
Yes.
And to some degree, even though this part of the state was very much, most of the state was very much part of the Jim Crow South, there was a level of tolerance here that didn't exist in other places, like Reynolds County.
Right.
Sure.
So as long as you behaved in the prescribed manner, you were okay. But, I mean, that's really what it was.
Now, General Price, in his anger, didn't he blow up part of the mine, or did the mine come back open after the war?
Well, the mine reopened after the war. Mainly the closing and reopening of the mines was all economic conditions. Mm-hmm. It was all different periods of economic panics and that sort of thing, or the price of iron would dictate when it would be economically feasible to have the mine going. But, yeah, they did set the charcoal pile on fire. But, they didn't blow up the mine, per se.
And then in the 1870s and 80s when you had the granite quarry start taking – started coming in, and that was another big, large economic boom for the county, and that was a lot of immigrant workers. You had a lot of German, Scotch, and Irish that come here in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s that worked in the granite quarries.
Well, I'm going to take a break here. We'll come back and talk about some of the tourism things to do, a little bit of education and history here in Iron County on Show Me Missouri, the history of Missouri one county at a time. I always like to thank, before we take a break, our sponsors. Missouri Farm Bureau lets us come here and talk about the history of the county with some of their members and friends. Co-ops Association, Missouri Association of County, CFM Insurance lets us bring you the history of Missouri one county at a time. And this week we're here in the historic courthouse, the true battle-scarred courthouse in Iron County. We'll be right back.
Here's something worth shouting.
From the hilltops to the rooftops, you're a member of an electric cooperative.
That means you have a say.
A voice in how your co-op is run.
In what's best for the community.
Power to the people.
For the people.
From the people.
Doesn't that sound good?
Learn more about the power of your co-op membership
at togetherwesave.com.
We are Missouri's electric cooperatives. Learn more at membersfirst.coop today.
Welcome back to Showing Missouri, the history of Missouri one county at a time. Commissioner, there's three things that always matter, and in Iron County they were tied together. The railroad and the Civil War cut through, obviously, no county more than this county. But when the co-ops come and run electric to the farms, that totally revitalized rural Missouri Live. What co-ops serve here?
Well, the one that serves us is Black River Electric Co-op. Mm-hmm.
Out of Fredericktown, right?
Out of Fredericktown. It serves the southern half of Iron County. The northern half is served by Ameren Electric. But the co-op for the southern part of the county, where I lived, on a little rock farm, we got electricity when I was 4 years old. So I remember growing up under the kerosene lamp.
When did you get a fan? That's always a big deal.
Oh, a fan wasn't until I was in high school.
Yeah.
You know, running water was when I was a preteen. So bringing electric to Iron County was a big economic boom to us under the Rural Electrification Act. When they formed the co-ops. That really brought a lot of new mining technology to play and really started the growth in the southern part of the county and in the west end as well.
I think if you ever drive down Highway 67 and you have time to look, they built a beautiful building there with the copper roof and everything, but they got this statue to a lineman. And you might take a lineman for granted until there's an ice storm or something, and it's 95 degrees at night, and that lineman, or it's freezing cold, and that lineman does it when he's needed. You're darn glad he's there, and they have a really cool statue of a lineman in honor of what they do out in front of there. That's I always thought that's a really appropriate touch to add to that building. I think it really sets it off.
Well, the lineman in this part of the state, of course, it's hills and hollers and mountaintops. So when you're running electric across this terrain, if you would, it takes a big skill. And to get back into those days when they first brought all the electric in, there was a lot of hard work done by those people, and they still do it today. When we're out of electricity, we just take it by normal that you flip on a switch and the world turns on.
Until it don't flip on.
Until it don't flip on.
And, there's no Wi-Fi. There's no.
We appreciate our Black River Electric Co-op a lot in our county. They do us a great job.
So the first schools come in around 1860, the first public schools. Commissioner Campbell, tell about the schools today.
Well, you have Iron County C4 School, Bellevue R3, Arcadia R2, and South Iron, what's South Iron?
R1.
So you've got four school districts today, and you've got.
I played ball at Arcadia. I went to Neelyville. We played ball at Arcadia Valley. They can hit a little bit.
Yeah, they're not too bad. then volleyball girls this year went. They come in second state. So
is that right?
Yep. So they got a pretty good program here. I went to Bellevue R3 school, and Bellevue is just a kindergarten through eighth grade school. And then you got the choice of either going to Arcadia Valley or Caledonia Valley R6 for high school.
Is that right?
So it's just a small school. And then the first charter school was in Bellevue. It was in 1860 at Bellevue there, which was called Crossroads back then, or a little before that. It was called Crossroads. And if you go in the middle of town today, there's four ways. You can go south, east, west, or north. And that's so that was called Crossroads then.
The St. Louis people, I guess, about every 30 or 40 years want to consolidate all the rural schools. I wonder how far off they are. They're about due to come down and try to mess with us again.
Yeah, and Bellevue is a very rural school. There's no city or municipality inside the Bellevue School District. It's all rural agriculture, ground farm. There's no mines or quarries or anything like that for its revenue. And its population, school population's down below like 190 now. So it's getting pretty small. So
I went to a K through 12 or K to 6. It was like that. We have to fight all the time to keep it open. The city people want to. They are real smart.
That's a real problem that we're going to face.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's been talked about in the last couple 3 years. I served as school board president at South Iron School District for over 18 years, and the nearest town to that school district is 20 miles. By Burnham, the nearest school to them is 25 miles probably.
Or more.
So when you start consolidating schools, and we did this over the years. Desark School was consolidated into the Annapolis school system, which made it the South Iron
School District. The difference when the local folks do it, right?
There's a difference when they do it than when you're forced to do it because of someone from St. Louis or Kansas City thinks that you're not important enough.
And they're always convinced they're very important.
And when you lose your local school system, as we have in many schools, where John and I used to be neighbors in Southern Iron County, we had the O'King School. Mm-hmm. And that was a community in itself. And that school went away, and so did that community.
Yeah.
So in these small rural counties, when you lose your school system, you're losing your community at the same time.
Always find it interesting. You know, city people, they think they got it all figured out. There's a few parts of them cities I don't think got it all figured out, you know, smart as they are.
Well, you know, we need each other to survive.
That's
we
right.
need
That's
each
true.
Other to survive. The only problem is that conduit is closed off, and we don't have that conduit that connects us anymore. When you talk about Iron County and how it grew, we were a tourist attraction for people in St. Louis that would ride the railroad, the Iron Mountain Railroad, into Iron County to visit and summer camp and tourism and bring your children. Some of those people ended up staying.
Yeah, long in the 1870s, 80s, you know, people come down from St. Louis to Ironton.
So we still need each other today. We don't need a barrier between the urban and the rural.
You think a way that really may change, though, is you got this broadband bill, right?
Yes.
Now you're going to be able to, the co-ops are going to be able to bring broadband to places. And some parts of rural Missouri have got it through some of the stimulus stuff and everything. But now your co-ops are going to have the chance to see if that works. I don't know whether it'll work for everywhere. But I just think if you have folks that can live in a beautiful place like this and buy twice the house and buy some land, and if you have an internet connection, you got to have that connection to the world. You can live here and be an hour and a half from 2 hours from the airport in St. Louis. It changes your whole. The internet has technology is most every technological innovation has hurt rural Missouri. This may be the first technological innovation that turns that tide and builds those connections.
If we use it right and if we promote it right, you can connect to the world. Either in St. Louis or in Iron County, if we get broadband and we can build that technology where we can have economic growth, why work in St. Louis when you can live here?
It sure beautiful ain't nothing country. Wrong with living in Afton, but boy, if you could live in Arcadia Valley, I don't know how you'd pass it up.
Well, that's the reason why I'm still here. I mean, I have opportunities to live in New York and Chicago and California. I chose here.
Ain't no place like it. I'm with you. Let's talk about a little bit of the politics history. Iron County is a unique county, and you'd mentioned some of the trends. African Americans had moved here and found a good home here. Most of rural Missouri started voting Republican for president sometime in the 80s. Then they'd come down to the state house sometime in the late 90s, early part of the millennium this time. And then a lot of the courthouses have flipped. Iron County is a converse to that in many ways. Even, I believe, it voted for President Obama, right, when he first ran in 2008.
2008 they did.
That is an anomaly to a lot of the state. What makes Iron County have that interesting kind of mix of bucking political trends?
I don't know if it's an interesting political phenomenon, I think. And John summed it up pretty good earlier, is most of the people here just want to be left alone.
Yeah. Well, independent, too.
Very, very, very independent. So they take an approach that what is best for us and what's best for the people around us. And sometimes they'll vote the D, sometimes they'll vote the R.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that Iron County is what you call the political stronghold for one party or the other.
It does seem like counties wave, and maybe Hill. I've always found Hill people are more stubborn than other folks. And maybe they just don't.
We're more passionate.
Don't blow in the wind, you know.
As some people call me here, I'm a very compassionate commissioner because we care so much.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's if it's the R or the D that makes the world turn differently for us. It's what's best for the people that mm-hmm. live here, and where do we see the future?
Which has traditionally been how Missourians have been.
Traditionally, that's how Missouri has been.
A little less now, I think.
A little less now, a lot less, in my opinion. But I think there's good things and bad things about internet and social media.
Mm-hmm.
When you live on a hill and you see nobody for weeks and weeks and weeks, and social media is the only friend you have, sometimes your viewpoints get directed a different way.
I can see that.
Okay, so I really don't think in Iron County it's really what political party you stand for. It's what you stand for that matters.
And Iron County has traditionally just been conservative valued people.
Yeah.
We're in the same courthouse that we had since the beginning. There wasn't an addition or modernization done to it until 1964. and then it was just a modest addition then. And we just like to live a conservative valued life and just not be messed with a whole lot.
Well, let me ask you about some of the notable folks. Speaking of politics, there was a president of the Missouri Senate very early on in Iron County's history, Thomas Essex, newspaper guy. I guess he had a whole bunch of businesses, but he could not have been in the Missouri Senate long because Iron County hadn't been around long. But by around 1870, he had been elected president of the Senate. Any recollection of that senator or his family?
Not that I've heard of.
Well, speaking of newspapers, one of the first ones we could find history of was the Ironton Furnace. Come back mm-hmm. in about the time the county was formed. Any old stories about the Ironton Furnace or newspaper?
The Furnace was an abolitionist newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
It was Colonel James Lindsay was the one that started it, and Lindsay was an abolitionist. In his views, he was a big supporter of Lincoln, and in fact was named he was given the land office appointment after Lincoln was elected. But the paper didn't last that long.
Mm-hmm.
The real newspaper that started here, the first real one that lasted, was the Iron County Register. It came about after the end of the Civil War. It started up about 1867. And lasted into, the 1960s before it was
become the Mountain Echo.
Which Mountain Echo actually started down in Annapolis, mm-hmm. moved to Ironton as a competitor to the Register, and then eventually bought them out. But the person that's most associated with the Register was a man by the name of Eli B. Ake that was actually at the Battle of Pilot Knob, fought there.
Which side?
He was Union.
Union.
But he was a Democrat, if I'm not mistaken, post-war in his feelings, his leanings. And he was the editor of that paper all the way into the early 1900s.
Yeah.
At the time, he was the
oldest
editor of any newspaper in the United States.
I think it was over 50 years, I think it was, altogether.
Yeah. That's amazing. Now, Chris Carr, NBA player out of Ironton.
Mm-hmm.
Commissioner Campbell, what folks think about Chris Carr?
Well, I don't know so much about Chris Carr or the AV part because I went to Caledonia School.
Sure.
So I don't really know much about AV High School.
we went to church with Chris's family, his mother and Chris. And Chris was probably 3 or 4 years old. And he was always a well-behaved boy because his mom made sure of it. I played basketball against his brother, John Carr. My son played against Chris Carr. So it was kind of known Chris for a long time. He was quite an athlete, was a very good citizen of our county, and done some great things after he graduated AV.
Played for the Suns, the Celtics, Bulls, had a pretty long career, about 6 years in the NBA.
Yes.
Sounds like your son probably didn't enjoy playing against him too much. You know?
Well, I didn't enjoy playing against his brother either. Yeah. Both of them were very talented young men. They were good basketball players, and Chris had a great career.
You come around here, I think the view off of Tomsock Mountain is one of the most amazing things you'll see with the dam that they have there. Elephant Rocks is beautiful, but I gotta ask you, if you're listening to this, you might have a chance to intersect with Jeff City some. There's some columns there at the Governor's Mansion that come out of here. Tell us a story about Governor Brown before he was Governor Brown and how these came about.
Well, B. Gratz Brown lived in the county for some time. He operated one of the local granite quarries. At the beginning of the Civil War, he volunteered on the Union side and actually was in charge of one of the first regiments that was made up here in Iron County. But he wasn't really involved with the military for that long here. But then after the war, he becomes a United States Senator. He becomes the 20th governor of Missouri. And those beautiful red granite columns that you see on the governor's mansion, he was in large part behind those being there.
Interesting. Out of St. Louis with another tie here to Iron County. Before I ask you the last question, my favorite question I like to ask folks, I want to thank our sponsors, CFM Insurance, so good to us, let us come around to the county to talk about the history. The Missouri Farm Bureau, we talk about rural Missouri. You can't talk very long without talking about Farm Bureau. Missouri Association of Counties, and like we talked about, Missouri Association of Electric Co-ops, they've helped keep the lights on so we can be here and be able to record this. Commissioner Campbell, you're going to have somebody come down to Iron County, what's something you'd show them? What's something they should know about Iron County?
Our natural beauty is probably the number one. I've heard more people say when they come here, we have a meeting with them from either Jeff City or St. Louis or out of state, the drive through Bellevue Valley into Iron County from Potosi is probably one of the most beautiful drives that they've ever seen. And that's down 21 Highway out of Caledonia. You drive alongside of Buford Mountain, which is the third highest point in the state. And that valley, which is rich in history, back to 1780s. And then you come over the hill and then down into Arcadia Valley. And when you do that, you see Shepherd Mountain and Cedar Hill, Cedar Mountain. And then you drive past Ballapolitnob Historic Site into Ironton up to the courthouse. And that's just probably one of the most beautiful drives and areas that you'll see in the world.
I tell you, I'd had a bad day, long day one time. I was driving, come back to St. Louis, heading Poplar Bluff. And I ended up just kind of stomping. And I'd driven it before, but I'd really just, you know, it's a place where they didn't have a cell service at the time. And I drove down from Fredericktown over. And those WPA projects there by the water, that was... You know, it struck me the right day, but it is an absolute. If you're out for a drive in the state of Missouri, you take that trail all the way up to where you're talking about now, and that is, if you don't think that drive's beautiful, you are just moved to Manhattan. You don't deserve to be in Missouri anyhow. Sir, I thank you for joining us. The history that you've grabbed has been an amazing thing. Mr. Abney, where could folks find you on the internet? Where could folks find the museum? Give me an address.
Yeah, the easiest way to find us is to find us on Facebook. Just go in and do a search for the Iron County Historical Society. You'll find our phone number, our address, our website. Everything is right there, and it tells you where our location is. And we are Right now, we're on our winter schedule, so we're only open on the weekends. We're open Friday through Sunday. Fridays and Saturdays, we're open from 10 until 4. Sundays from 1 until 4. And then beginning in April, from the 1st of April through the end of October, we're open 7 days a week.
If somebody were to come and bring a car full of people and let you know in advance, somebody let them in, though?
Absolutely. Yeah. All they got, we have
message you on the internet.
We have hosted tour buses in the past, and
or you can take an Amtrak to it, right?
Well, you can take Amtrak down here now. You sure can.
Now, Poplar Bluff, the Amtrak comes through about 2 a.m. What type of date is it?
About 4 in the morning here when it's on time. The northbound trains, it's closer to the end of the route, so if it's going to be late, it's usually going to be on the northbound route that they're late. But when they're on time, it comes to about 4 o'clock.
Yeah, well, 4 o'clock ain't that bad.
It's not. And southbound, it's 10 o'clock at night. So, again, that's past my bedtime.
Well, you can come here and spend the entire day.
There you go. Commissioner, I love the passion for the area. If you had somebody coming in from out of town, what's something you might take them to see, and what's something you'd want them to know before they left about Iron County?
I think one of the things that I would encourage people to do when I brought them here is to take a look at the calm, realistic people that live here. The people that live here know the history, they know the beauty of this county, and you can take it from Viburnum all the way through Des Arc. We have, the landscape is just immaculate. But the thing that makes that passionate to me is the people that protect that, that have lived here all these years by choice. Not because of the economic value, but because this was a choice that they wanted to live in. They wanted to live in that world where people leave you alone, per se, and you can raise your children, and you can raise some cattle, you can have a horse, and they just want to show people that don't live here how important we are to the rest of the state. Iron County has gave a wealth of economic development to the state of Missouri. And all we ask in return is a little investment in who we are and a little compassion about what we stand for and why we're here. Because without Iron County, a lot of things in St. Louis, it probably would have existed at some point.
But not when it did.
But not when it did. If it wasn't for Iron County, the columns in the mansion would not be there. So Iron County has done a lot of good for the state. We just like for people to come and enjoy who we are and what we stand for.
You know, it is an interesting thing sometimes for people when you talk about a state budget or something, be like, well, we produce X revenue. We do X for the state. There is a bill that Iron County could hand the rest of the state that they ain't never been paid if they chose to.
Absolutely.
You always look at a moment in time. Well, there's history that leads to that moment, you know.
We talked about the mining. The mining has been the integral part of Iron County. And the mining that is left today is pretty much the lead mine and the quarry mines. The lead, all the lead produced in the United States comes from Iron and Reynolds County. Every drop of it.
There's only two counties in the United States basically produces all the lead.
And that's us.
Amazing legacy, amazing history. I can't thank you all enough for the hospitality. Appreciate you letting us come here and visit with you. That was the history of Iron County on Shoal, Missouri. Next week, we're going to be in Bollinger County. We'll talk about the history of Bollinger County, dating all the way back from George Bollinger to today. I want to thank everybody for listening this week, and we'll see you next week from Bollinger County on Shoal, Missouri, the history of Missouri, one county at a time.